things on pieces of paper, you know, the message was stuck on in lines of tape.
Yeah.
So it was the real thing, and it was delivered to him. They went to him, and they had this thing made out and said, Representative Pierce, regarding your vote on House Bill 333, fuck you, strong letter follows. We're all set. Is this your format you've been using most everybody?
Yeah, pretty much everybody.
You know, you get down here, some of this stuff, what conclusion you draw from your experiences as a participant, and that's hard. Those are tough.
Yeah. Well, do what you can.
Okay, I'll do
okay,
what you can.
Okay, we're running. Okay, I'm interviewing Harrison Fagg. Harrison was a state representative from Yellowstone County from the election of 1968 to the election of 1984. So a total of 16 years, and also served as the House Majority Leader. And whip, too?
Assistant whip.
Assistant whip as well. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so anyway, Harrison, where were you born and when?
Born in Billings, Montana. Haven't been here all my life. I was born in 1931.
And was there anything in your upbringing, anything that kind of got you interested in politics and public service?
Yeah, there was, I guess. From day one, I came from a quite an active political family. My father was state secretary of the Democratic Party.
The Democratic Party.
And at the same time, my mother was Republican Central Committee chairman for Yellowstone County. And so we had a mixed household. My grandma, she was probably closer to John Birch than she was to anybody else. Very, very conservative lady. So we had a very
My
mother's mother, yeah. And so we had many heated and interesting discussions in our house on politics.
Now, is this something that, like, goes back? I mean, traditionally, was your mom's family Republican?
Yeah. I don't know much about, my mother's family was always Republican.
Going back to the Civil War and right. That type of thing?
I think it goes back forever.
Yeah.
Now, as far as Dad's concerned, I think he became a Democrat, or he got interested in the Democratic Party because of a gentleman by the name of Grover Sissel. Now, Grover was the state chairman of the Democratic Central Committee when my father was a secretary. And my middle name, Grover, is after Grover Sissel.
Okay.
So
he's probably named after Grover Cleveland.
Very possible. Yeah. But they were, you know, in those days, though, a Democrat wasn't a Democrat like today. They were conservatives.
Yeah.
Before Dad passed away, Dad died in 52. He's a very young man. We always thought he changed substantially and ended up being, at that time, a Wendell Willkie Republican.
Yeah.
That was about when, the fact is that Dad died the day after Wendell Willkie got his nomination.
Were there political discussions between your mom and dad when you were a young man?
Oh yeah, heavy stuff, funny stuff too. Mother, they in those days they had what they called torchlight parades. I don't know if you ever heard of a torchlight parade, but every car and walker carried a torch, and mother, as the head of the Central Committee, always led the parade, and Dad and got his car out and took every Democratic banner that he could get and put on it and rode next to her all the way through the parade. So that brought, and another kind of funny thing, though, they used to argue over politics a great deal at the dinner table, and Dad always seemed to get the best of it. And I remember one time my grandmother turned to Mother, who was named Frances, and she said, "Frances, I may have to live in the same house with a Democrat." And she said, "I may have to eat dinner with a Democrat, but by George, Frances, I don't have to sleep with one." And she marched off the bedroom. So yes, there was a lot of that going on.
And you were included as a young person.
Oh yeah,
in these conversations. You listened in and chimed in, and so
it was always, we always had a very formal dinner, and we always, so at a very early age, I was introduced to politics. So there's certainly came along. And
did you consider yourself a Republican from early on, or did that something that kind of evolved, or?
My first political meeting was a Democratic Central Committee meeting here in Billings. And I'd come back from the Air Force, and I was trying to decide where I wanted to go politically. And I went to their meeting. That was the first one. Subsequently, I went to a Republican Central Committee the same year. And I thought they were eons, light years apart in philosophy. And I certainly tuned in with the Republicans more than the Democrats. So I became a Republican at that time. But I went into it, I think, with a very open mind.
And that was when your dad was kind of drifting maybe a little bit more toward the Republicans.
No, Dad had died by then.
Oh, I see. Okay.
No, but Dad was, this was in must have been about 1954, 55 through there, and Dad had died in 52. But, and then, of course, I married into a Republican family.
Yes.
My wife died in the old Republican.
Yeah.
So.
Was there, can you remember what about the Republicans kind of clicked with you better than the Democrats?
I think at that time the big issue was the Democratic Party was the party of labor and to a great deal the party of spending and more state control, and the Republican Party was more extreme in every case from that. And I was more of a free enterpriser, and I liked the Republican Party because of it.
This was after you graduated from college as an architect?
Yeah, I graduated from college as an architect, served 2 years in the Air Force as a first lieutenant, and then came back to Billings. And of course, you have to apprentice for 3 years, and I was in my apprenticeship position then.
And you realized that as a small business person, as you were going to, you know, that was your aspiration, certainly, was to have your own business, that you felt to get more compatibility with the Republicans and the Democrats.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No question about that.
And this was during the period of the 1950s?
Yeah, this is the middle to late 50s when I came back and started getting involved more and more in politics. At the same time, I was very, very active in the Junior Chamber of Commerce, the JCs.
Oh.
And they were very much to the right side of the spectrum,
yeah.
And so I think I picked a lot of it there. I mean, key lines in it like economic justice can best be run by free men through free enterprise, things
yeah.
like that. That was the JC creed, and so I think I got a lot of it from that as well.
Did you become acquainted with Orvin Fiari?
Oh, very well.
In the JCs, I know he was involved in.
Yeah, Orvin was the national vice president, and
yeah.
I later became a national vice president of the JCs. And my last real encounter with Orvin Fiari, I flew him in my Bonanza into Terry, Montana. He was going to be the keynote speaker at a meeting that when I was state president. And probably shouldn't put this on the record, but as we landed, there's two things on a Bonanza. One retracts the flaps and one retracts the landing gear. And I was waving at the crowd and hit the wrong one, and right in front of the whole crowd with the congressman in my plane, I retracted the landing gear, and we skidded in on the belly.
Holy smokes!
Yeah, the people are still laughing and telling me about that. Anyhow, so Orvin was a good man, and he was a very active JC.
Yeah, I remembered that about him. Mm-hmm. Now, in the 1950s, as you're developing an interest in politics, I suppose. I mean, did you mentioned you went to the Central Committee meetings and that sort of
mm-hmm.
thing, and you were involved in JCs. Was it occurring to you then that you might be interested to run for public office?
Not at all. How I got into politics, had a call one day from Jim Batten's office, and they asked me to come down.
Jim Batten was the congressman.
Yes, Congressman Jim Batten. And Lou Alakasich was his key man. I guess Lou's still around. He's still hanging on. And Lou said, and Lou had been very active in the JCs too. He'd been a state president of the JCs. And he said, I've liked what you've said and what you've done in JCs. And he said, you're a natural to go into politics. I'd never given it a thought. He said, why don't you run for office? So I ran. And I ran for the state senate. There were 14 ran. And I ran in eighth place. We elected seven.
Huh. So that was when, in 66?
That would have been the year before, yeah, 66, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Well, that's neat. So mm-hmm. you didn't select yourself. They.
I was asked by, I considered it a real honor to be asked by Jim Batten to run.
Mm-hmm. You bet, yeah, mm-hmm. you mm-hmm. bet.
And as long as Jim was alive, we were very close friends, and I think we tuned in pretty close politically.
Yeah. Well, I remember meeting him as a young boy at a Republican state convention, I think in 1964, and being impressed with him.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jim, of course, grew up in Billings.
Yeah.
He was in my sister's high school graduating class, and so I'd known him when I was a little boy, you know,
yeah.
8, 10, 12 years old, him coming up to the house and shooting hoops with him, that sort of thing.
Would you consider him to be the most important Republican leader for that period of time?
Without a question, yeah. Jim was by far the
very influential.
Very influential. He was the strongest man I think we've had in Republican politics, perhaps forever. He was a politician.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a politician's politician. He played everything right, and he voted right with Montana, and he was just a class act.
Yeah. And then was appointed by, I believe, Nixon as a federal judge in
yes.
1969.
Mm-hmm. And he, I know when he was appointed to be federal judge, he had about 25 of his closest supporters, I guess, and friends over to his house, and explained before it came out publicly
yeah.
why he was doing it. And it was simply, he said, most people wanted him to run for the United States Senate, and he would have been a shoo-in, in my opinion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we needed a senator at
yeah.
that time.
Yeah.
But he said his wife just had a terrible distaste for Washington, D.C., and she didn't want their two daughters to grow up in that atmosphere, so he had a chance to get out, and he did.
Yeah. Is his widow still living?
As far as I know, she is. I haven't seen her for a long time, but she...
And he died relatively young.
Yeah, he died. He was a pretty heavy smoker, and he died of lung cancer.
Yeah, I see. Mm-hmm. And so you then, so you just missed for the Senate in 66.
Yeah, I ran seventh out of it was six to elect. And I mean, I was running against some tough guys, Jim Hoy, yeah. Jerry Anderson, George Darrow, Jim Felt. I mean, there were some heavy guys in there.
Yeah.
Bill Gowen, there were some big guys in there, and big vote getters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so then in 68, you ran again.
I ran for the House then.
For the House in 68. Mm-hmm.
And that's, of course, we didn't have single member districts then, so we ran at large. And I believe that year I led the ticket. It was, I think probably my name is pretty well known from the time before, so
sure.
I came out pretty well.
Advantage. Now, had you been in Helena before? Like, had you seen the legislature in session before you arrived
no.
as a representative?
Never.
What were your first impressions? Here you are, this young, idealistic guy. This is a wonderful honor, this opportunity to serve in the state legislature. What are your first impressions of the Montana legislature?
You know, it's a terrible thing to say, but my first impression of the House representative was like a zoo. Everybody running which direction. Lots of noise and lots of confusion, and it was so hard to, you know, you were there, you know the
yeah.
same thing. It's hard to, at least it was hard for me to get orientated, to know who all the people were, and to know their families, to know their politics,
yeah.
and then all of a sudden it settled down into an entirely different arena. But yeah. when you first get there, it's
overwhelming.
It's overwhelming, totally overwhelming, yeah. And so much going on, and so many bills, and you know, I came from an office with a secretary and a desk and all the things, and to go up there and do my own filing, you know, and write my own letters, it was different.
Did you have a young family then?
Yeah, we had. I think we had the same family we have today, and they grew up in politics. Of course, my son Russ really grew up in politics.
Yeah.
As you know, he became a state legislator, and now he's a district judge.
District judge, that's right. Mm-hmm. You have other children?
Yes, I have a daughter, Cheryl. She and her husband now are not really active in politics, but they're interested in politics. They run my architectural office. They're both architects.
I see.
And then the youngest son, Grant, he's in a landscape and nursery business and rental equipment business.
Okay.
He owns several businesses.
Here in Billings.
Here in Billings, yeah.
I see.
So they're all living in Billings.
Yeah. And so was there a legislator maybe that might have impressed you, or a lobbyist, or anybody especially?
Oh, a number of legislators stand out, you know, over the years. Jim Lucas is certainly one that I could set my handle on. Bill Gowen.
Before we get to Bill Gowen, Lucas, describe him.
Young, attractive candidate, very, very, very articulate, extremely articulate, good sense of humor, incredible grasp for words and presenting himself. He was just already a fine guy.
And he was Speaker of the House in 69
yeah.
when you arrived there.
Yeah, and then I think the next year too, he repeated.
Yeah, because he was when I was there in 71
mm-hmm.
as well.
Yeah. No, Jim was a, and I consider him a close friend still, and he's just was a very, very fine guy.
Yeah. Gerke?
Who?
Harold Gerke.
Well, he was... Harold was different. He always seemed a little bit, although he came from Yellowstone County, he always seemed just a little bit aloof. He was hard to get close to.
Yeah.
He was
called
distant.
Him the Great Stone Face.
Exactly. He was always hard to get. And, you know, we came from now. The only time he ever really warmed up is when he needed your vote, and that was when his big cause down here was the university system and getting buildings for Eastern at that time.
Yeah.
And then he could be a charmer, very, very pleasant. But as you say, the Great Stone Face. You
yeah.
couldn't say it any better than that.
I was opposed philosophically to gambling.
Oh, so was I. In fact, I think the biggest, if there was one point of the legislature that I would call my black hole, the most disappointing day of the legislature was when gambling passed.
Yeah, and I, you and I were on the same side of that.
Yeah.
And so was Gerke.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was Speaker,
yes,
he might have done the same thing to you, Harrison, but there were, well, after the 72 Constitution passed,
mm-hmm.
it was possible for the legislature to consider gambling legislation then.
Right.
And Harold put me on more than one conference committee
mm-hmm.
as the Republican conferee
yeah.
because he knew that I had the same point of view on gambling that he had.
Yeah, I know. At another great legislator, I think, was Francis Bartono.
Yes.
And I remember the day the gambling bill passed, he made a speech and he said, the state has just sold themselves out to a prostitute. And he said, when you sleep with a prostitute, you turn into one, and pretty soon you depend on that. And I'll never forget it. And that's what we've done. We're depending on gambling.
Local governments are heavily dependent on it.
Yeah, and Francis's words comes back over and over and over again.
He was
a good, in my opinion, he was a very good legislator.
What do you remember about Bill Gowen?
Bill was a charger. He liked to take on the world. He really wasn't happy if he wasn't arguing and in a heavy discussion with somebody. I guess is that how you saw him too? And he was always involved. And they say, of course, when he died, he was flying a plane in a dangerous situation, and instead of when he crashed the plane in such a manner that his daughter, I think it was his daughter or son that was with him, lived, and he was killed.
Yeah.
He was just that kind of a guy.
Yeah, I've heard that story before too. I never really knew him because I think that plane crash occurred in 1969 or 70, and I didn't arrive there until 71.
Yeah, I think might have been, that's about when it happened. All right, he was a great guy. His sister Nancy was more conservative than he. He came, of course, he had the bottling company here in Billings.
Oh, I see.
Coca-Cola, no, Pepsi-Cola, not one of the bottling companies. Knee-High Beverages,
yeah.
Knee-High Beverages, yeah.
Was he an influential and important Republican during that period of time here in Yellowstone County?
Well, you know, he didn't really care for Jim Lucas, and he ran against Lucas for Speaker.
Oh.
And, of course, I supported Bill because he was from Yellowstone County. I really, in my own mind, I thought Lucas might be a little, would be a better man.
Yeah.
And, but Bill was the kind of guy, he came up to me afterwards and he said, I know you supported me, and he said, you may have made some enemies out of it, but he said, anytime you need help, you come to see me and I'll take care of your problem.
Huh.
So, I mean, he
was a loyal friend.
He was a loyal friend, yeah.
Yeah,
of course, his folks and my folks were very good friends, and they did, socially they were friends, and so the Gowen family and the Fagg family go back probably in the early 1900s.
You mentioned that, that Jim Batten was the powerful and important Republican influence.
Mm-hmm.
During that period of the late 50s and 60s up into the 70s, were there other individuals that you can think of here in Yellowstone County?
Oh, yes.
That were pretty prominent during that period?
Jerry Anderson, very, very. Jim Felt, probably he was the guru of the legislative finances for years and years and years. He could put together a budget and see where we're going to be better than the fiscal analyst could.
Yeah.
There was a number of George Darrow, environmentally, but a very strong, strong, good legislator. There were a lot of them that came out of Yellowstone County.
How about in the business community? Were there business leaders that were maybe especially influential during that period of time?
Oh, in Yellowstone County, the key man at that time was Russ Hart, Hart Album Company.
I see.
Without any question, he was Mr. Billings.
Okay.
My dad had been Mr. Billings. In fact, is when Dad died, the Gazette editorialized us that we'd lost the leading citizen of Billings and called him Mr. Billings. Well, after that, Russ Hart came along and was Mr. Billings.
Your dad was the postmaster, wasn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
But he was a whole lot more than a postmaster. He was president of the Chamber of Commerce, I think, for 6 years in a row. He was on a number of state committees, highway committees, getting roads into Billings.
Yeah.
He built the YMCA, raised the money for the YMCA. He was more than a postmaster, but he was very influential in the community.
When you know, back in the, it's hard for those of us who lived through it to imagine that it could have happened, because the Anaconda Company and the Montana Power Company, the so-called terrible twins, you know, on the business side in Montana, were pretty prominent.
Well, the
Anaconda 50s and
Company,
60s and 70s, and then they just disappeared.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on
yeah. Several things. The Anaconda Company owned the Billings Gazette, and they owned all the papers in the state. And when they sold the papers, they lost a lot of their influence. I know, and I take a little bit of pride in it. I passed the Hard Rock Mining Bill. There was an editorial in the Gazette and said the man who broke the copper collar. And it was about how the first time the Anaconda Company had ever been beaten in the Montana legislature. Well, it was a good bill. It was a necessary bill.
Was it your bill?
It was my bill, yeah. And but it wasn't so much that it was my bill. It was just Anaconda Company had begun to lose a little bit of the grip. We still had Lloyd Crippen up there. Everybody liked Lloyd. He was an effective lobbyist, but we also had Ted Swindon as governor. He liked the bill, and many things were working for it.
Yeah, and that was the, as you say too, they really weren't at their
peak anymore. But when they owned every paper in Montana.
Yeah.
Of any size.
Do you remember the watering hole?
Oh, do I remember the watering hole? There were three of them, but they had one of them. The S&H Green
Center. See, those things were gone in 1969. 69 was the last session that there were watering holes.
Okay, I was there.
But I wasn't, so tell about those.
Well, the watering hole. At the watering hole, there were three of them. S&H Green Stamp said one. Anaconda Company had the second. I think the power company had the third. I'm not sure. But you could go. They were a room in a hotel, a motel, normally over at the Holiday Inn. And you could go there. You could get anything from a T-bone steak to a bottle of whiskey, and at the same time be briefed on what was going on in the legislature. And it was that you left the legislature and you went to the watering holes and then you went to dinner. And everybody did it.
It was kind of a melting pot.
Melting pot, yeah.
People could socialize, yeah, and talk politics and that sort of thing.
I don't know of a time that I was ever lobbied hard in a watering hole. It was a social hour.
Now, were they just a motel room?
Just a motel room,
It wasn't very large.
No. But there were three of them.
You could get a lot of legislators in there, could you?
No, but you had three of them, and you made the rounds if you were a regular attender.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I guess I may have been the last session of the watering holes, but they were made up to be a lot more in the paper than they really were. But you could. They catered to you. Anything you wanted, you could get at the watering hole.
So describe what would happen. You just the doors open, I suppose. And
yeah, the door was always open. You just walked in, and you want a drink. There was a bar there.
They had a bar set up somehow. Maybe they have a cold cut. Maybe you have a bear and a beef.
Oh, they always. That's the second thing. You could have they have a complete meal there, or you could stay and drink all evening long, or you could take neither and just visit.
Yeah.
But it was
almost crowded. Smoky?
Yeah, they were smoky. Yeah, they were smoky, and they were crowded. I mean, I don't think I've ever been to one that it wasn't. But that was where things happened.
Yeah.
That's where you did your lobbying, one legislator to another.
Did you see many Democrats there, or do you recall?
No, there weren't as many Democrats as there were Republicans. It was primarily a Republican hangout.
All three of them?
No, all three of them. But Democrats came to them, don't get me wrong. But it was primarily, I think, more the Republicans. They were the big business, run by the big business, Anaconda Company and the S&H Green Stamps, which doesn't sound very big, but it was a big block up there.
Yeah.
And the Montana Power, and they were more Republican-orientated than Democratic, so the Democrats stayed away from it, pretty much.
Did you notice that there's been... I think some have observed that the Anaconda Company might have been a little closer to the Democrats and the Montana Power Company a little closer to the Republicans.
I think that's true.
You would see some of that?
Yeah, right? I think that's true. Yeah. And I think their lobbying effort was that way too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you might see some Butte Democrats at the Anaconda Company watering.
Yeah, they come over. The Butte Democrats frequented that quite regularly.
Do you remember any other Democrats? I know it's a long time ago.
No, I really can't. I know at that point, the Republicans pretty much held out in the Montana Club, and I can't remember. There was some bar down on Montana that the Democrats hung out in primarily.
Like the Rialto or the Jesters.
Yeah, one of those. Yeah, and then they begin to change. But, the tenure of the party changed. At one time, when I first started serving, the Republican Party, by and large, had a higher, I think, educational level than the Democratic Party. They were more college graduates and people that more white collars there. And the Republican Party perhaps wasn't as astute as the Democratic Party wasn't as astute as the Republican Party. That, of course, has changed. But I remember one time, the Democrats, Jim Murray, interesting guy, but he was head of the AFL-CIO, and I turned around one time, I was on the floor of the House, and I looked up, and Jim was putting his thumb in there, and then he would put his thumb down, and I noticed that seemed to correspond with votes. And when his thumb went up, the board went green, and when his thumb went down, the board went red. And so we passed that around the floor, that it seemed like it was being pretty much run by the gallery. And so I think Lucas was chairman then, Speaker of the House. He said, let's confuse him. And they started making a lot of quite difficult motions and things to follow. And it got the Democrats confused. This wouldn't happen today, I don't think, but at that time it did. And so at that point, when you got the Democrats confused, he crossed his arms back and forth, and which would mean call a recess. And then he'd go meet them down in the lobby, and he'd say, now this is what's going on. And then he'd go back out and direct again. And that is an absolute happening.
That's incredible.
Yeah,
wow.
it really did happen on key labor votes. Not on all votes, but on key labor votes, and things that Jim Murray was really interested in. Now, Jim's a good friend. I saw him not too long ago. We sat reminisced over it. I got the Sheraton Hotel built primarily because of Jim going out and finding me laborers from around the United States. When I couldn't get bricklayers, for example, he'd get on the phone and give me bricklayers. And so I'm not saying this derogatory, but he did. He had a heavy command of the legislature at one time.
The Democrats in particular.
The Democrats. The Republicans never followed him at all. But it was the Democrats. If they had Democratic control, and he would sit to the left of the Republicans, and so most of us would be looking forward. You don't turn around, look backwards. Yeah. But the Democrats could look up and see him.
They could, because he was seated in the gallery on the Republican side.
Exactly.
The Democrats could see him. The Republicans were too close; they couldn't see him.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And he was very effective.
Literally giving hand signals.
Yeah. But that would not happen today, and it only happened one or two sessions, but he was helpful on the bills.
Did he ever lobby you?
Oh, we just agreed to disagree.
Yeah.
I particularly when we on the sales tax, Jim never could give me a real argument why we shouldn't have a sales tax. So we maintained a good friendship.
What do you remember about that sales tax issue?
Pay more, what for?
That was in 1968 when Anderson was elected over Tim Babcock.
Exactly.
But then in the 71 session, my first session and your second session, there was a battle royal over the sales tax.
Yeah, and that's when we put the 10% surtax, wasn't it, versus the sales tax on the ballot,
wasn't that
the session?
30% surtax.
30%, yeah. And that was when Jim Lucas was basically, I think, running for governor more than anything else, and the Republican Party was going to make that their issue.
Do you remember a story about a briefcase that was mistakenly left in an elevator?
Yes.
Tell that story.
I don't remember that much more than about it, but that was a lot of the financial records and that sort of thing were lost.
The story that I think I remember hearing was that Jim Lucas was involved in an important leadership way in getting the sales tax passed.
Yes.
And there were some records indicating who some of the key contributors were, which apparently included some of the major corporations in Montana. Apparently had made important contributions to the sales tax effort, and I'm not sure what else, but the people who were involved, who in many cases had corporate ties, and this information was in Jim's briefcase, and he carelessly left his briefcase in the elevator in the Capitol building. Well, who do you suppose recognized his briefcase but Jim Murray, the lobbyist for the FFL-CIO? So Jim thought, well, I'll return Lucas's briefcase to him after I carefully examined the contents. So he did, and found out this information and made photocopies of, you know, what was the most damaging to the pro sales tax side, and then he exposed them as a bunch of corporate lackeys and that sort of thing. And of course the sales tax came crashing down, importantly, because of that. And Jim Lucas's political career went with it.
Yeah. And as I recall, at that same time, that same briefcase ended up in the hands of Ken Nibel here in Billings, who was the person running the campaign for the sales tax. And he lost it, and then the press started after him, and he disappeared on a vacation. It was quite a fiasco in there.
Holy smokes.
And so
you remember that Nibel lost the briefcase and it wasn't Lucas?
No, I think Lucas may have lost it, but in the meantime, I got back to Lucas, and then Lucas didn't want any part of it, so I believe he gave it to Nibel.
I think that's
and
right.
Nibel then lost the suitcase, and then the press started after him. How could you lose such a neat thing? And then that's when Ken Nibel went someplace on vacation.
Now, Nibel was what?
He was just a Republican. He ran KBMY
radio.
He ran the KBMY radio station
here in Billings.
Good guy. A good Republican, and he was the chairman for the sales tax.
And remember too, that 1971 session lasted for a long time.
Mm-hmm. That's when we covered the clock.
Yeah, and the problem was the Republicans had the majority in the House and wanted to enact a sales tax, and the Democrats had the majority in the Senate
and didn't want to.
And didn't want to, but were amenable to an increase in the income tax, which the Republicans had decided had been increased enough.
Right.
And so that an impasse developed.
Right.
And we ended up being there, I think, until June, didn't we?
Right. About until June. We went out, and then we came back in again, as I recall. Yeah. And we stayed there into June. And then I think that's when it eventually ended up on the ballot, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And that's when I remember we served. I think we were serving as 66 Republicans, and the next session we served as 33.
Yeah, wow.
It wasn't a popular thing.
No, it wasn't a popular thing, that's for sure. Now, you served as in the 69 and 71 sessions prior to the 72 Constitution.
Yes.
And then for several sessions after the enactment of the 72 Constitution. Any thoughts on how the 72 Constitution might have changed the legislative process?
Well, I don't know. One thing, of course, they went to annual sessions.
Yeah.
And
briefly.
Briefly, yeah. But yeah. I think I served in two annual sessions,
yes.
and then they went out. I think they.
Why do you suppose the people got rid of annual sessions?
Well, the rural people were so afraid of the legislators,
yeah.
And they're so afraid of the legislation that might be passed. And they always said that the less government, the best government.
Sure.
And so, and
yeah.
they voted it out.
Yeah.
But no, I really don't know that it was a great impact. I think certainly it was an improvement for the state. But I think probably the biggest single issue on the legislature was when we went to single member districts. And of course, that was federal legislation.
Yeah.
And because you see, you take Yellowstone County as a for instance, we always said we called the straight eight and then the final 12 or something like that.
Yeah.
We elected nobody but Republicans.
Yeah.
Well, if you take Billings and if you run an east west line through it about Polly Drive and go up north about six blocks, you're at the Rimrocks. Well, that at that time was about 80% of the voters, and it was 100%, almost 100% Republican in this district.
Yeah.
So we were electing, and I'm sure other districts were the same way. We were electing, and once we went to single member districts, we had a totally different type of proportional representation.
Cindy Lockram, who I interviewed earlier today, mentioned that when the legislators were elected at large, he said that of course the countywide vote total was important, so it kind of forced legislators, regardless of where they lived, to listen to the guy who was the Farm Bureau guy,
mm-hmm.
and to listen to the AFL-CIO guy, and to listen to the Billings Chamber of Commerce guy, and so on, because they were all important in the whole county.
Mm-hmm.
But he said he felt legislators tended to take a narrower point of view when they just had to represent their constituents in a single member district.
I don't think there's any question about it.
Yeah.
And I think that so many legislators, were very concerned about re-election, so they used to civic to a district, they changed their viewpoint.
Yeah.
Some interest. My legislative district at that time was the only district in the United States, in Montana at least, that didn't have a bar and had two colleges.
Huh. Wow.
And also, and as poll was, I think, the highest education because of the two colleges. It was a different kind of a district. Well, you see, you take that kind of a district, it's highly Republican, and it's just impossible for a Democrat to get elected in.
Yeah.
And so if you continue to vote the Republican trend, you're pretty difficult to get beaten.
Yeah. And it was a good fit for you, I think.
Yeah, I had no real problem with it.
Yeah. Because the tavern keepers have been an important influence in the legislature,
right.
But they obviously weren't much of an influence in your district.
None at all.
Now, the environmental movement, the first Earth Day, I think, occurred about 1970 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And the environmental movement was just beginning,
mm-hmm.
as you were a young legislator.
Mm-hmm.
And so any thoughts about that?
Yeah, when the environmental movement started, we had some real, I think, some people in the state that were really concerned about the environment. And at that point, there'd been a lot of heavy power by the big companies, the Anaconda Company and the Montana Power Company, and some, they were pretty much anti, and they really didn't care, ripping a ruin, so to speak. And I think there was a genuine movement of sincere people to get an environmental climate in Montana that was friendly to nature and try to get a balance. And that subsequently changed, and the environmental movement became more of a cause to stop business than it was to protect the environment. But at the very beginning, it was a genuine effort, and I think we passed some very good legislation in the early 70s that did that. You were a part of it.
Yes, right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. There was a particularly controversial bill, I think it's called the Wild Rivers Bill, and you paid a price for that.
Yes.
Can you tell that story?
Sure. I was awakened one night about 3 in the morning, maybe 2 in the morning, not just sure, and it said, your cabin's on fire. And I said, my cabin's on fire.
Was it an anonymous telephone call?
No, it was from the fire department.
Oh, I see.
And
this is a wilderness cabin up near Nye?
Yeah, it was more than a cabin, though. It was really quite a nice, it had about 1,200 square feet, and it was quite a nice cabin. It was above Nye, and it burned to the ground. And so that was...
Why?
It was totally an arson, yeah. And interesting, the state fire marshal went up there and said, a woman burned down your cabin. And I said, how can you be so sure of that? He said, well, he said, I can tell you, guarantee a woman tried to, because it's amazing how they can track a fire. These guys are very, very good. He said, a man would go up there and throw a can of gasoline and throw a match and walk away. He said, the person that burned down this cabin took wood out of your wood pile and made it a pile on your front porch and slowly got a fire going there, and it slowly started and burned up the side of the cabin. And he said, I can trace the fire all the way through the cabin. Now, he said, a man would have never done that. It was a woman. Interesting, about a year later, a lady came up to me at a land use conference. She said, did you ever find out who burned down your cabin? And I said, no, I never did. And she said, well, maybe I did. And in kind of a kidding way, I said, well, Mary, you're bad, but you're not that bad. And she said, don't you be too sure. Well, whatever the case happened, my cabin was burned down.
That was Mary Donahoe?
No, not Mary Donahoe. No, I was strongly on my side. She was on my side.
Yeah,
right?
This is another Mary.
This is Mary from the Big Timber Valley.
I see.
And I don't want to get into last names because I have no proof of it. But
yeah.
It was interesting. Right shortly after my cabin was burned down, her husband invited me out for a steak dinner. We weren't friends at all, and I went off into the times. Why did he bring me out for a steak dinner? So
maybe that.
I think he was saying, I'm sorry.
Why did those people do that to you?
Oh, the bill. Two or three things happened. The bill was during the winter when a lot of farmers weren't busy, and one of the farm newscasters, went on and said that some things that were totally untrue about the bill, and then that got involved lots and lots and lots. Many times over. One of the things that said that every river that was in the Wild and Scenic River would be fenced, and the cattle couldn't get to their water. And as I told many people, if there's one-tenth of the things you think was in that bill, I'd be against it too, but it's just not that kind of a bill. But it's funny how things heal. I just talked to a guy on the Smith River. He's got a ranch on the Smith River, and I'm talking about it. It's a dude ranch.
Yeah.
Spending some time there, and he said, I was one of the guys that really hated your bill. He said, but I had my own. He said, I think we needed something.
Yeah.
And so, but that's the background of what I'm
saying. Remind me of what happened, because I guess I remember the Wild Rivers Bill, but you also mentioned the federal. What was it, Wild and Scenic?
Yeah, there was the Federal Wild and Scenic Rivers Bill. It was the bill that I had, Bob, was a bill that was taken from a piece of model legislation that had been used across the United States.
I see.
And was a law of several states. I think South Carolina was one of them.
Okay.
And so I just took that model piece of legislation down to the Legislative Council and had them draft that into a bill, and included four or five rivers in Montana that I thought needed some kind of control, particularly the high portions of those rivers.
Yeah.
And it was basically a bill that required some setbacks for construction from the river. That's about the thrust
that
of the bill.
That was mostly what was in it.
Yeah, but it got interpreted by something totally different. I had death threats three times while I was in the legislature. I had a call in, they were going to kill me and kill my family. one of those scariest moments in my life was my good friend Senator Mitchell was the cause of it. I still kid him about it. We left the session one day.
Harry Mitchell's a Democrat from Great
Democratic
Falls.
From Great Falls, yes, yeah. and a very good friend. But he, I left, and my wife was with me, and she got in her. She walked to her car, and I was walking to my car, and I got back to my house. And a half hour later, she hadn't come. And, you know, this is when the death threat was out. And I was really getting very agitated and concerned. Well, come to find out, she ran into Harry Mitchell, was standing on the street corner talking to him. So,
oh, boy.
And I still tell Harry, he about cost me about half my hair and lots of gray.
Oh, boy.
And we also had another bill that was kind of interesting. I think I'm the only legislator that was ever taken into a legislative hearing under armed guard. I was carrying a bill for the League of Cities and Towns. It was an annexation bill, and there was a wild guy from Butte that decided it was going to lead to one world government, and he was going to kill me.
Oh boy!
And he showed up at the meeting, and I'm walking down the hall in the Capitol with my wife. All of a sudden, there's a National Guard on both sides of me with a rifle. And I said, what are you here for? And he said, we've been told to put you under protective custody. And I got down to the meeting, and the Duke police came over and said, don't worry about it. He said, the guy that was making all the threats, he said, we took care of him. And the Duke police testified for my bill. So,
are you having fun?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Reminiscing?
Yeah, we're reminiscing.
Mm.
Yeah. Let me think. The wonderful debate that so many of us remember was a debate over Representative Dorothy Bradley's coal moratorium bill.
Mm-hmm.
And it was between Lucas, Jim Lucas, the Speaker of the House, and John Hall, who might have been the Democratic floor leader at the time, but it was a prominent Democrat.
He was
the
minority leader at that time, yeah.
What are your recollections of that?
Well, it probably, as you point out, it was probably the most eloquent debate I've ever heard. And they went on for, it seemed like forever, back and forth. It was just a very well done, and both of them very articulate, and they both made very good points. And frankly, I was surprised about John Hall. I expected out of Jim Lucas, but Hall did a magnificent job.
Now, what would the bill do? Dorothy Bradley's bill was a coal moratorium.
I can't recall all the details. That was a coal moratorium where we were going to stop coal mining for a period of time, and I can't remember all the particulars.
And do you remember what happened to the bill?
It didn't pass.
But remember, it passed on second reading.
Yeah.
And then it was on the board.
Yeah.
For a long time. Mm-hmm. Remember that?
Yeah, it bounced up and down on the board.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, that board is an interesting thing too, where that board is, and how you keep a board on third reading.
Yeah.
When I had I can't think of the name of the bill. I'll think of it in a second. Why am I having memory loss? It was. We bounced around and bounced around and bounced around.
What was it about?
Economic development, where you use taxes to defer. You froze the taxes in a geographical
cell. Was that your bill?
Yes.
The Milda bill?
No, the Milda bill is my bill, too.
Oh, oh, okay.
Now, this is where you froze taxes in a given area, and then all the new taxes that came into the area went into urban renewal and development projects.
Isn't that sort of what the Milda bill did?
No, the Milda bill was a little bit different. The Milda bill was, if I can oversimplify, the further you live from the source of the service, the higher your taxes. As an example, here in Yellowstone County, the people at that time, and pretty much the same now, that lived out in Yellowstone Club subdivision, maybe 10 miles from the sewage treatment plant and the water treatment plant, paid the same tax as the people that lived downtown. So I tried to say that if you wanted to live out in the country, and if you wanted to be a part of urban sprawl that cost you money, a sheriff's call or a police call to mm-hmm. the country was certainly a lot more than one in downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically, my bill set up their taxes were proportional to the cost of the delivery of services or your cost living in that community.
Okay, that's ringing a bell to me too. There was some kind of a concentric ring.
Yes.
Because I think you had a.
Yes.
You had a something I saw when mm-hmm. you presented it.
Yeah, I did many different type of visuals on it, but that was one of a concentric circle. Because it is true, the people that live in the rural area, now they're getting around that now because they're putting special improvement costs in taxes to bring lines out, and it's not like it used to be, but at that time it was not that way at all.
Yeah.
Then I also had, if you could remodel your house and make it more tax efficient, for example, you could get tax breaks and things of that nature.
Yeah, and these bills were sort of involved in the early environmental movement.
Yes.
I mean, they were kind of, we were saving energy and we were trying to plan intelligently and that sort of thing. So they were somewhat in keeping with that era, that period.
Yeah, they came along a little later on. The one I'm grasping for the name of is where they where you took a it was an urban renewal bill, if you might call it that, where you froze the taxes in a geographical area. And why don't you shut that off for just a second, or could you shut it off? I have a metal block on that. Just a second. Darn it.
And that was the
tax increment financing bill.
Okay. You said Pat Williams jumped up to argue against it?
Or? No, for it.
Well, for it.
We had it there, and it was complicated, and it was controversial, and the League of Cities and Towns had presented it to me and asked me to carry it, and we had a lot of trouble with it, and particularly with the rural Republicans, they didn't like it at all, and so we were talking a minute ago about third reading, and you can keep a bill on third reading indefinitely if you want to by moving it to the bottom of the board or the top of the board or someplace, and I kept moving the bill back, because I know one of these afternoons, it would be a real hot, steamy afternoon, and people would be mostly asleep. And so then I, on that particular day, I moved it down to after House Bill 332 or something, you know, so yeah. I knew it was going to come up right away, and without making, and I, it came up, and I got up and explained the bill. It's just a rather simple bill, done by the League of Cities and Towns, and it was to for the betterment of downtowns, and I explained a little bit about it. But then Pat Williams, who was not the, the champion of the Republican Party, particularly the conservatives, jumped up and said, I think it was like 10 years ago, this or 20 years ago, this would have been socialism. He said, this is the finest bill that's ever come before the House of Representatives. And he just about killed the bill with kindness. he woke up everybody.
Was he considered pretty partisan then?
Oh, very partisan, and not liked at all by the Republican, by the conservative Republican bloc. The real conservative people were really down on him.
Yeah, he was outspoken.
Very outspoken, yeah. And another little story that could come up when with the sales tax. You touched on that. Yeah. John Melcher was getting ready to run for Congress. And every time there came time for a vote on House Bill, I think it was 333, John went to the restroom. And one time, getting ready for a vote, he went to the restroom, and Bill Gowan got up and he said, you know, members of the Assembly, I think we should just go on recess for a minute because Senator Representative Melcher just went to the restroom, and I know he wants to vote on this bill. And about 5 minutes later, red-faced John Melcher came on, and Bill got called his bluff, and he voted.
Finally got him. Got him to vote on.
That was Bill. I said he was a fighter.
Did you serve with Melcher? What,
yes.
Just one session.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Any recollections of him?
Just he's a very nice guy, I enjoy John, and of course we served with Max Baucus too.
Yeah.
And of course the story of Max Baucus that may be fun to pass on is Jim Burnett, our had a key to the Capitol. He was the only legislator because he was a farmer and he got up early, and he had the key, and he went down there one morning about 4 o'clock in the morning, and here was Max Baucus up before all the television cameras putting on a campaign speech.
Up in the gallery.
No, he was down on the floor. He was a member there, and he had every right to be there.
Yeah.
But he wanted to be taped in the chambers.
So real early in the morning, he was just doing a
dynamite speech addressing the
even though there wasn't anybody
there wasn't a soul there, but nobody knew that, but Burnett broke in and caught him. So Jim never let him live that down. I still get to kid Max about it every so often when I see him.
You know, did you work with any legislation with Dorothy Bradley, Representative?
Yes.
Dorothy Bradley?
Mm-hmm. We worked on several bills together. She was a very effective and very bright, articulate lady. And I think she's a very good legislator.
And she was associated with the environmental movement.
Oh, totally.
Particularly.
Yeah, I think 100% with the environmental group.
She was also associated with another pretty controversial bill.
Which one is that?
Remember that one? The abortion bill?
Oh, yeah, very much so.
What do you remember about that?
Well, I don't know. I obviously diametrically opposed her on that particular bill. I remember one day she was walking by me in a restaurant, one of her friends said, well, what's such an issue? It's just a bit of protoplasm. And a pretty hard statement.
Yeah.
And so Dorothy and I certainly split on that.
Yeah. Dorothy had a bill that was introduced, I think, maybe prior to the Roe v. Wade decision.
Yes.
That would have made abortion legal in Montana.
Yes. I think up to the second trimester, I believe. It was quite late in the pregnancy.
And so it was, of course, horrendously controversial.
Yes.
Because, and most of us voted against it, as I recall. Mm-hmm. There were, I don't even know how many votes in addition to Dorothy's own vote the bill got.
Yeah, very few.
But then a couple of years later, after the Roe v. Wade decision came down, then the legislature passed some abortion legislation, I guess, to implement Roe v. Wade in Montana or something. Is
something
that how you
like
remember
that.
It?
Yeah. I can't remember that. I remember those were the days we had the Equal Rights Amendment, too.
Yes, yeah.
I remember one day I got cornered in the elevator with the ladies. They had a Bible in one hand and they had the Constitution in the other hand, and they stopped the elevator between floors. And here's Harrison in the elevator with probably 20 women.
And they were opposed to the Equal
they
Rights
were,
Amendment.
They were very much opposed to the Equal Rights Amendment. They were giving me all the reasons.
Yeah.
And I'm in the back of the elevator. I can't get out, and they stop it.
Holy smokes.
It's kind of like when
I voted for that.
Mm-hmm. I voted. I did too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it was necessary legislation.
Yeah.
But that didn't endear you to the hearts of the conservatives.
No, and I never really could understand why.
I couldn't either.
Yeah.
But there were some, you know, there were bills that you couldn't understand why. But like when I carried the Hard Rock Mining Bill, and of course, in Where's Helena? In the center of small mines. And there's probably 300, 400 little mines around there.
Yeah.
And I was, if you may remember, the small miners came in droves. I just felt like there's always 10 or 15 of them around me. And then we finally put the small miner exemption in there. And they were gone.
No problem. Yeah.
And you know, they turned out to be wonderful people after it was over with. That was the session, I think my cabin was burned down. And one of them invited me over to his place and invited me out for dinner and showed me his mine. And it was very, very gentle, very nice person.
And oftentimes I think things do work out well mm-hmm. that way too. You served in the legislature with several governors, Governor Forrest Anderson and Governor Tom Judge and Governor Ted Swindon. Mm-hmm. And you probably met them all.
Knew them very well, all three of them very well. Yeah.
Let's begin with Governor Anderson. Any thoughts or impressions that kind of typify him? Any experience you ever had with him?
He was a real politician. And he really did play politics hard. He was a hard politician, hardball politician. And he, no holes barred with Forrest. He was out to get his way. And he, the best I could say about him, he was a strong politician.
And he was very much in opposition to the sales tax.
Yeah, you know, he was the voice against the sales tax, you know, yeah. And we still have in deference to Forrest. I think that's when Pay More What For came up.
Yeah.
And we still have that. You know, you talk about a sales tax, and there's still Pay More What For. You hear it occasionally.
Describe him in terms of his demeanor, in terms of what was he like?
Well, he was very sharp, very quick, very positive. He very opinionated. He was fun to talk to in many respects. But we set down the barriers early in life that his values and my values in many cases weren't the same, and so we just agreed to disagree. And from that point on, we were friends.
Yeah.
But he was probably the most political governor. Of any. Tom Judge would have been a good second to him.
Describe Tom Judge.
A nice guy, fun to be around, pleasant, affable, but a politician.
Would you use the same descriptive terms to describe Tom Judge that you would Forrest Anderson?
No. Forrest Anderson would basically, he would go to any extent, in my opinion, to make his point. He played hardball. Tom played politics more as in softball. Tom was a unique person. I think he had a good sense of values, whereas I don't think perhaps Forrest had that same sense of values. Tom did have a real deep sense set of values. I remember one time I was state president of the JCs, and Tom was a featured speaker, and it was in West Yellowstone, and we had about 1,000 young guys there and their wives. And I remember he knocked to me, he said, if I had a political race like this, nobody could beat me. And then he says, you're not thinking about running, are you?
So that's what the thought that occurred to him when he saw the JCs. It wasn't
anything
service,
but
it was politics.
It was politics, but but he. How would you have judged him?
Well, I think pretty much the same way. Forrest Anderson was Newell Anderson's father.
Right.
When I was a college kid, I was student body president at MSU in Bozeman, and Newell was the student body president at Northern up at
right.
Haber. And so we knew Forrest Anderson through Newell.
Mm-hmm.
And so and he was, I remember he had a kind of a brusque demeanor, but he was especially nice to us college kids because we were friends at Newell's, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember him that way. And then I don't remember him, didn't have much to do with him actually as a legislator.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember him as looking like a governor. He had that mane of white hair.
Yes.
He was a handsome looking guy, even though he was small in stature. He had broad shoulders and he was well proportioned. He seemed to have a kind of a sort of a confident sort of an air.
Very, very confident.
Very confident and very in control.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a kind of a heavy voice. And he was, as you mentioned, smart and articulate and quick and tough.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody that you just kind of had the impression, you better take this guy seriously.
Right.
And Governor Judge was young and he was an immaculate dresser.
Yes.
He was kind of debonair, kind of a... kind of a Prince Charming kind
yes.
of a guy,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Softer voice, kind of softer approach.
Mm-hmm.
I guess those are kind of my recollections of him.
Mm-hmm. But a real politician.
Yeah.
You know, bringing in the first case with you, I was down in Arizona, and we had the Arizona days down there, Montana days in Arizona, and yeah, your opponent, the now governor, came down, and Tom was introducing him to the crowd, and he came by and said, "And this is Harrison Fagg, he's a former majority leader," and he, Schweitzer just walked right by me, and he grabbed me by the shoulder, he said, "You know what you did? This guy was a former leader of the politics in Montana." He kept right on going, which satisfied me, but it was interesting.
He probably knew you were a Republican.
Probably so.
He was probably wise enough to know that and just thought this guy isn't going to do me any good.
Yeah, exactly, but he, but it was interesting. He came all the way to Arizona to get votes.
Yeah,
I don't know if you ever knew that. But
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I was down there, too.
Oh, yeah, I didn't see
maybe,
it.
Maybe not at that same one.
Uh-huh.
But with the Montana reunion in...
I remember talking about Alan Kolstad. Alan was the chairman of the Montana days down there when I was that one year.
Yeah.
And he got up and he said, "This is probably the most distasteful job that I've ever had in my life." But he said, "A potential governor for the state of Montana is here." And he said, "It's my job to introduce him."
Well, he was a good one, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Alan was a good one, that's for sure. How about Governor Swindon?
He was a smart politician. The other guys maybe were hard politicians and soft politicians. I'd put him down as a smart politician. He was very shrewd and very, very quick. I remember when I was majority leader, and I thought it might be good to start the session and kind of adjust. And so I sent to California, and I got an olive branch. And so on the first day of the session when he came over, I presented him with the olive branch and said, "This from now on, we wanted to be friends," and that sort of thing. And later on, at the very end of the session, as we always get them polarized, and we got apart, and they brought the leadership over to the governor's mansion to meet with him. Yeah. And he'd saved that olive branch, and it was in a floral vase in the center of the table when I sat down.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah, that was, but I think that sums him up. He was a good politician.
Yeah.
And a good guy. I think a very honest man, too.
He was, I always thought he was, the term, he embodied the term competent.
Yes, yes.
He understood state government thoroughly, and I remember one time I asked for an appointment with him. I guess maybe, you know, I can't remember what it was about. He probably still could.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went into his office, and he's wearing a flannel shirt.
Yeah.
And I think corduroy pants or something or other. It was probably not during a legislative session, but he was very informal. And you'd think that there might be a top bureaucrat or two that would be there in the office with him to discuss in specifics what I wanted to discuss with him.
Mm-hmm.
He, I don't know, I don't think he ever needed anybody like that.
Mm-hmm.
He had such a thorough understanding of the details of state government that he could conduct a conversation perfectly confidently by himself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he did.
Yeah.
And he also was decisive.
Mm-hmm.
He could make a decision and look you in the eye, and you'd know what would happen.
Exactly. And he stuck with you. I know when he was land commissioner when I did the Hard Rock mining bill, and a tremendous ally. And it was a difficult bill to pass, and we finally got it passed, and I'll never forget it, he called me up, and he knew I was a Republican, of course, he was a Democrat, and congratulated me on it, and very much impressed with the guy.
How did you come to run for majority floor leader?
You know, I don't know why, I think that I was concerned about where the taxes were going more than anything else, and I thought I could be persuasive, and another thing, I thought I could work with both the liberal and the more conservative of the party, because I tried to be in the middle. I think some people thought I was more to the liberal side than the conservative side, but I tried to be in the middle. I just thought I could work with them, and I thought we needed to get some things done.
Was it a contested caucus?
No. I think I basically ran unopposed. I think it was very... But
and who was the speaker during that session?
Marks.
I see. That was what, 81?
81, I believe.
81. And so what does the majority leader do?
Well, I think the best thing, the biggest thing the majority leader does is try to unite the Republicans and make sure they're all on the same team. And then the second thing he does is his job is to present the Republican position and argue it with the opposition. And I think those are the two big jobs that we had up there.
So the speaker is the speaker of the whole House.
Yes.
He's an officer that's an officer of the Democrats as well as the Republicans, the minority as well as the majority. But the minority leader and the majority leader
mm-hmm.
are just elected by their party caucuses.
Mm-hmm.
And so the majority leader is kind of the war chief of the mm-hmm. the majority party, yep. and the minority party is sort of the war chief of the mm-hmm. of the minority party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember.
Who was the minority leader? Do you remember?
Yeah, from Great Falls, Dan Kemmes. I mean, from Missoula, Dan Kemmes.
Okay.
Dan Kemmes's final speech. He said, "Harrison, the difference between you and me, when you give a talk, he said, you always win." I was the majority leader. and he says, "I always lose." He said, "When you stand up thinking we had 53 votes," he said, "you always have 53 lights." And he said, "And I always have 47.
Well, that's how it works.
That's the system.
Do you have any recollections of Kemmes?
Yeah, very articulate, very, very bright, extremely bright, and on the genius level, I would say. He was and a very, very liberal, very deliberate thinker, very positive thinker, and I think a progressive thinker.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he went on to be speaker sometime later.
He became speaker later on, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. He was very low-key, very low-key.
Any recollections or anything of any other prominent political leaders? I'm thinking maybe Senator Metcalf or Senator Mansfield. We talked about Batten. Did you ever meet Mansfield?
Oh, yeah, I knew Mansfield quite well. You see, I have a tie to Mansfield because my father, we go back to where we started now.
Yeah.
My father was active in the Democratic Party, and Roosevelt got him nominated and made him the postmaster. And as a result, he was very close to Mansfield, who was active at that time. Burton K. Wheeler, Roy Ayers was governor. And so because of Dad's tie to Mansfield, after Dad passed away, Mansfield was still in power.
Yeah.
And because of his friendship with my father, we became, you know, not good friends, but friends, speaking acquaintances. A real statesman, no question about that.
How would you describe him?
A statesman.
Yeah. How did he come across when you had a visit with him?
Very calm. He'd puff on his pipe and kind of look over your head sometimes, and then he'd kind of come back and ponder, and then come back with an answer. Nothing quick or fast. He thought things through very well, and he was always a gentleman, a real, real gentleman.
Metcalf
was a neat guy. Of course, I enjoyed him because he at that time I was pushing the Beartooth Absorkey Wilderness Act, and he was a strong supporter of that.
Yeah.
And fact is, his untimely death probably caused that bill to pass with no modifications. It became a tribute to him, and it just went through it, and it was highly controversial. It's another story. It's not, certainly not a state legislation, but there was the Beartooth primitive area and the Absorca primitive area, and they were divided by a gold mining road that had come through the top of the mountains, and it went from the top of the Boulder River into Cook City. And their heavy, heavy faction wanted to keep that road open. It would have been a much easier access into Cook City than the Cook City Highway. It was actually a water grade all the way through. And so we were trying to unite the two so the road wouldn't separate them. And that's why I got involved in that, and he became a close friend afterwards. I wanted to name a mountain in Montana after him, as a matter of fact. And his wife said that was a high honor, but she didn't want to do that. And I found out afterwards that they named the whole wilderness area after him.
Yeah, the Lee Metcalf Wilderness Area. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But he was another fine. But you don't get elected to a high office in politics without having a lot on the ball.
And he was somebody that you had a good relationship
yes.
with. Yes. Because you hear Metcalf and Mansfield described differently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Mansfield is typically described as a statesman, whereas
yep.
Metcalf is more of an advocate, more
yep.
of a...
A scrapper.
More of a scrapper.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But no, I had no problems with either one of them as a Republican. I think they were, I considered them both, you know, not good friends, but close acquaintances, yeah. you know.
As you look back over 16 years of service in the legislature and then having had that experience, you know, you've lived a nice, good life longer than that, and you've been more than an astute observer of Montana politics. Can you draw any conclusions? Are there any important lessons that you feel you've learned?
Well, in my life,
back as a lifetime.
Well, of course, I think some things have happened very definitely in my span. Is that we going to the single member districts? I had an incredible difference in the composure of the legislature. Incredible difference because all of a sudden, minority areas and low voting areas got representation, Indian reservations, the south side of the Billings, and that sort of thing. And so that brought in a lot of new faces and different types of voting patterns. I think that was one big thing. I think another thing we've seen as we've as Montana has grown up and developed, the rural area has diminished, urban area has increased, and so we've gone more from a solid conservative state to more of a borderline liberal state, and we might be almost a purple state now, you know, in the balance.
So because in this day and age, when conservatives and Republicans run well in a state that's called a red state,
mm-hmm.
and when liberals and Democrats do well, the states that they do well in are called blue states. And
right.
So the term you just used, purple, means that Montana is now, we're probably more in the red category, at least
yes.
as far as presidential elections
mm-hmm.
are concerned. And now that's a little blurrier.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we used to be such a strong conservative state in Montana. And it was always peculiar to me because we would elect Democrats more on the liberal side, like Baucus and Metcalf, and
yeah.
And some of our governors have been more on the liberal side.
Yeah.
But yet we consider ourselves to be conservative. Now I think that's changing, and because of the more rural diminishing of the rural
yeah.
influence and more impact of the urban influence.
And the urban influence tends to be some more moderate, some more...
I think they tend to be more moderate. I think they tend to think they're smarter, and they tend to think they think things through. They tend to think they want to be more of the independent variety. They want to... they have a different attitude. They're not the hardcore right-wing or left-wing. Like when I first went to legislature, there was some strong differences between the Republicans and the Democrats. And I think that's getting, that gap is narrowing somewhat.
But you know, too, Harrison, I think that... in the 90s and in the early part of this century, the last three or four legislative sessions in particular, that our party, our Republican Party, seems to have taken a pretty hard turn to the right.
Oh, recently they've gone just...
Because guys like you and I probably mm-hmm. couldn't get elected to leadership jobs in the
no
last
way.
10 years.
No way.
But we could, you know, pretty easily 20, 30 years ago.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think the turn came with Mercer when he was Speaker. I think that was one of the big turns as far as the legislature was concerned.
Because
he was a real politician and he played hardball.
And he played hardball, but you know, even Mercer might have some difficulty now.
I think he would be too liberal by some of the standards.
By some of the standards now. Yeah.
Yeah. When I was down in Arizona and I picked up the USA Today and I see an article in there how the conservatives are going to start drumming out some of the Republican candidates in the House because they weren't conservative
yeah,
enough.
That happened here.
Yeah.
And there were two or three conservative leaders that listed 14 Republicans as socialists.
Right.
And identified them as socialists, some of whom, it's just absolutely laughable.
Well, like Bill Glaser, right?
He was one on the list. We know Bill. I mean, that is just preposterous.
Yeah.
But anyway, they've gone too far, I think.
They've gone too far. The pendulum's come back.
The guy that made the threat is Representative Roger Koopman, ended up being faced with a primary challenge of his own and didn't file for
Oh, really? I did.
So, mm-hmm. so he basically backed down from the challenge that he was going to deliver to everybody else.
When I was in the legislature, a Democrat came to me and he said, the Republican Party is like a guy looking through a keyhole with blinders on. And I thought at that, you know, we were pretty open at that time. Some of today would be a Republican would be looking through a keyhole with blinders on.
Yeah.
Some of them really don't have very much vision for what's going on around them. And it has turned it a sharp right.
It has turned a sharp right.
And I think it's going to hurt the Republican Party.
It probably will, although there was enough of a reaction to that that were a lot of those 14 guys found out that they had a heck of a lot of friends that they didn't know they had before.
I'm sure of that.
There was a... So in fact, I think what happened was that maybe this to some extent has seriously damaged, if not broken, the power of some of these real hardcore right guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is off the sale. Was Walt Sales related to the sales we served with?
The fellow that's the Scott Sales who is
Scott Sales and Walt Sales is the one we served.
They're not related.
Okay, I just was often
yeah.
wondering.
Walt Sales was a state representative from Bozeman,
right?
Back in the late 70s, 80s. Maybe.
Yes. Yeah.
And then this guy that we're talking about now is the ultra right wing speaker of the House of Representatives,
right.
also named Sales and also from Bozeman.
Right.
I don't believe there's any relationship.
Okay, I just always wondered. That. Well, it's there has been a noticeable change in Montana, certainly.
Well, anything else? Any as you look into Montana's future, what do you see? We've talked about that, touched on that a little bit already, but
you know, I think as much as probably some of us don't like it, natural resources is certainly a key to Montana growth, and if we can do it in the proper, sane method, there's no reason we shouldn't get into our natural resources and use them. I know the Stillwater Mining Company is mining up by our my cabin now, the one that was burned down, and they've done a beautiful job. As soon as they dig up something, they plant it back to grass. They're planting trees. They're landscaping, and it's a high class of workmen up there. I think we need to see more of that.
We can do a good job of timber harvest and mining and all kinds of things now with modern technology and modern knowledge.
And I think that's the key to Montana. We're sitting on a gold mine here.
Yeah, because the world will always need the resources we have, and if we can let the world have them without sacrificing ourselves in the process, we can probably raise our standard of living.
Yeah. I know a guy told me one time, if you should look at what Montana ships out and use it, and look to what Montana ships in and build it.
That's a pretty good line.
Yeah, that's not too bad a way of looking at it, and then make yourself a little bit more self-sufficient.
Well, that's for sure. Anything else?
Nope, that's it, Bob. I appreciate the opportunity.
You bet. Thank you.
We wandered a lot.
Thanks for your public service.